Well, good afternoon, everyone, or good evening if you're in the UK watching the American version of two British authors, but so it goes. We have Ian is holding up The Murder Wheel by Tom Mead, and I am holding up The Puzzle of Blackstone Lodge by Martin Edwards, which actually isn't out in the US for a little while longer, but they let us have copies. And Tom has a copy of Martin's most recent UK book, which he's going to hold up.
Here it is, Sepulchre Street.
Right. So I was just saying to Martin, he's almost as prolific as James Patterson, who can keep up anymore with everything that he's doing. So we do have copies at the store. Our Sepulchre Street, do we have any Sepulchre Street? I think we might have one or two signed copies left from London. And this book, The Puzzle of Blackstone Lodge, we did have, and it is a paperback original. And Tom's book, Murder Wheel, was our June historical fiction pick, or maybe it was our British crime. I can't remember. I guess it was our British crime book of the month. And again, thoughtfully, Penciler Publisher let us have it a few days early, so it squeaked into June. Tom, you might not know that.
Wonderful. No, I didn't. That's great.
Yeah. So that's why I don't have any copies. They all sold. We got our order, and I think we have like one, maybe one left. So every month at the Poison Pen, we have several book clubs. And by book clubs, I don't mean discussion clubs, but they're buying clubs. And we carefully curate the best of what's coming out in several categories. And then the club members have to take it willy-nilly. We have their credit cards. We just urge it to them. But we've done a good job of over the years. So Tom's book, and in the past Martin's had one, fall into the British crime category, but also historical fiction, because both of them are very interested in Golden Age history, crime fiction, and historical fiction, and also in puzzles as a leading plot element. And Martin might find time to talk to us about The Clue Finder, which he has brought back. Yay. So who wants to be the lead off, guys? Which one of you wants to start talking? Martin, probably ought to be you.
Yes, take it away, Martin.
Well, thanks, Barbara. Thanks, Tom. And hello, everyone. It's really great to be talking to you this evening. And with my old friend, Barbara, we go back a long way together, and your friend in Tom.
30 plus years is all, right?
It's a while, that's for sure. I think that probably the first thing I should say, in case anybody's confused, is that The Puzzle of Blackstone Lodge is the American title of a book already published in the UK under the title Blackstone Fell. Publishers in the States have changed the title, but it is the same book, and it's the third book in a series of mysteries set in the early 1930s, starring Rachel Savenaigh and her trusty, most of the time, sidekick Jacob Flint. And as Tom kindly mentioned, the fourth book in the series, Sepulchre Street, it has just been published in the UK a few weeks ago. It will be published in the States next year. Again, I think under a different title, not the same title in the States for that one. And I think that that's probably going to be out the middle of next year. So the book that I'm talking about today of my own is this third one in the series, The Puzzle of Blackstone Lodge. And it's really a book that can be read, I like to think, even if you've not read the first two in the series. Gallows Court was the first, Mortmain Hall was the second, but each book is intended to stand alone, even though you have the same lead characters in each story. But each book seeks to offer a kind of take on the Golden Age. And what I'm doing, I think, is writing love letters to Golden Age fiction, but of course writing them from the point of view of somebody at work in the 21st century. So I'm writing from, in one sense, a contemporary perspective. And I think that enables me to deal with some subjects that the Golden Age writers of the 30s weren't able to because of social taboos of the time. And also, I think it enables me to write with a kind of freedom that, in some ways, that wasn't always there in the golden age between the two world wars. So these books I find incredibly enjoyable to write, to put together. They are intricate mysteries, and we'll talk about clue finders shortly, I'm sure, because Tom and I are both very keen on clue finders. But really the idea of this series is to explore the social world of Britain in the 30s, some of the things that were going on beneath the surface of British society at that time, but above all, to present readers with pretty complicated mysteries, puzzles for them to solve, more than one puzzle in each book, and to have, I hope, a lot of fun whilst they're reading. So that's really the essence of the series.
Let me add too that landscape is a very important part of Martin's work in this series. And the reason I'm pretty sure that the title was changed is that it wouldn't be familiar to all American readers unless they've been living on Peter Robinson, whom we much miss. But the term fell is not really common to Americans. So tell us, Martin, what a fell is, because you're up in that North Country.
Yes, the north of England. The fells, it's a term often associated with the Lake District. I've written about the fells of the Lake District in the Lake District series, which is a contemporary series of police mysteries, detective stories. But fells are essentially hills. They're often quite small, certainly by international standards. But of course, England is not a country with many great mountains. So the fells are hills, and very often they're a defining feature of local communities in rural parts of northern England. And Blackstone Fell, the location, is inspired by a place in Yorkshire called, I think quite a wonderful name, Hardcastle Crags, which is a National Trust site, very appealing place to visit. And I spent quite a bit of time there after the first lockdown, researching the area, and Blackstone Fell is a kind of fictional take on that that part of the world, essentially in the foothills of the Pennine Range of hills, which is like the spine of northern England.
Right. Well, it's essential to the mystery that it be set there, and I'm going to hold up, you can barely see it, but the copy here I have comes with a nifty map that points out some of the key features of the buildings and the landscape. And the landscape even figures heavily into the way this book resolves what form of justice is actually achieved. So moving on, let's talk to Tom. And Tom, tell us all about the murder. Why your fascination with locker room mysteries?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, thanks very much, Barbara and Martin. And hello, everybody. My name is Tom Mead. This is The Murder Wheel. It's a follow-up to my first novel, which was called Death and the Conjurer. There it is. I have it in paperback here. Both published by Mysterious Press. And like Martin, I have a fascination with Golden Age crime fiction that goes back a long way, but with a particular emphasis on the puzzle and on the challenge to the reader, if you like. So the sense of the game of cat and mouse between writer and reader, that is what appeals to me, and that goes back to growing up in a house full of Agatha Christie paperbacks, of course, and then subsequently discovering the likes of Ellery Queen, who for a long time was quite tricky to get hold of in the UK, or at least I found it quite tough to get hold of the secondhand paperbacks. Of course, my personal favourite, John Dixon Carr, the so-called master of the locked room mystery, probably because he wrote so extensively in the genre, and he had a great imagination, a great sense of innovation in his work that He was not a writer to rest on his laurels. He was incredibly prolific and incredibly imaginative. He was a great writer, first and foremost. Like Agatha Christie, he had a great sense of plot and pace. But he also had a great gift for atmosphere, by which I mean a sense of, you know, the gothic, the slightly macabre, out there atmosphere which pervades the impossible crime mysteries. So locked room mysteries, basically, for those who don't know, I tend to use the term to refer to the impossible crime subgenre. So essentially a puzzle mystery that is built around a seeming physical impossibility. So a crime that is committed in such a way that it appears there is no human way that the crime could have been committed, hence the imagery of the locked room and the murdered victim found in a sealed space that was completely inaccessible. But I tend to use the term to refer to any kind of impossible crime. That there are various other examples, such as the no footprints problem, for instance, where, to go back to Carr, there's a great example in one of his short stories of a victim found on murdered on a beach with no footprints, for example, leading to the body. So that impossibility, which of course has a rational, logical explanation to it. Another example would be the impossible alibi problem, which is something that Freeman Wills Crofts specialized in. He was another big name of the Golden Age who I admire a great deal, though he's very different to Carr in tone and style. He was much more, an early figure in the police procedural genre. He focused on the mechanics of investigation, whereas Carr was more about the ingenious flights of fancy. But he would, in some of his mysteries, for instance, have a criminal construct a seemingly impossible alibi. So this would be achieved via incredibly complex technical means with railway timetables and incredibly elaborate methods. But I tend to consider all of these to be basically variations on the locked room problem, the seemingly impossible crime. So my first experience of the subgenre goes back to John Dixon Carr, who I've already mentioned, but also shows like Jonathan Creek on the TV. I know we've talked about that before, Martin, as one of the few really strong impossible crime focused shows that I can think of, really, apart from maybe the Levinson and Link Ellery Queen series. But I grew up watching Jonathan Creek when they were on in the early 90s. When I'm thinking about mystery writing generally, what I tend to do is liken it to stage magic. Because in my view, generally speaking, the principles are the same in that you've essentially got an audience who is entering into a kind of contract with a performer. They're going in to be deceived, and it's a kind of a good-natured deception and a sense of mystification, a kind of pleasurable mystification in both cases. You know that there's a trick going to be played on you, but that's the fun of it. So whenever I'm writing a murder mystery, when I'm trying to come up with a plot, I will often find myself going back to non-fiction works about the history of stage magic and about the gimmicks and the way that they that they work on in the minds of an audience. So effectively how to guide an audience's attention in a certain direction, which you know, this kind of principle of misdirection is also intrinsic to the puzzle mystery, with the red herrings, the plot twists, the deceptions, the disguises, the crucially misinterpreted clues. To me, it's all they're all kind of bound together, and that's why in my first book, Death and the Conjurer, I bring in my detective character, who in the classic Golden Age style is an amateur sleuth who is brought in by Scotland Yard to assist with a string of seemingly impossible crimes. He is a retired music hall conjurer. So he's essentially an old vaudevillian who has got a knack for unpicking these impossibilities, because like me as a writer, he sees the correspondence between the mystery and the stage performance. So the first book was Death and the Conjurer, set in 1936, and the sequel, though it is like Martin's, it's a standalone, is The Murder Wheel, where Spectre is back again for another magic focused theatrical Golden Age inspired impossible crime.
Well, before Martin chimes in with all of his expertise, there are two things I think are really worth noting. And I hadn't thought about it, Tom, until you said that. But, you know, the term cat and mouse is so often applied to thrillers, and particularly domestic thrillers of the, you know, which are such a rage at the moment. But it's always cat and mouse between characters in the book, you know, which one is going to succeed in trapping the other. But I hadn't really thought about the locked room mystery, the impossible crime, is really being a cat and mouse game between the author and the reader, which I think is a really wonderful spin to it. And the other thing I would point out is that in a true impossible crime, it's not really the why done it. The motive is not often as important as how done. So the focus in the book is less about motive and more about the mechanics, so the how done it part, which of course is a real challenge for the author, because if you're going to bring that off, you not only have to construct the impossible, but then you also have to construct the solution, or the whole thing falls flat.
That's it, exactly. I think the who and the how are the key elements in an impossible crime. In Crofts, for instance, sometimes you would know the identity of the murderer, but the fun of it, the puzzle of it, would come from how the detective catches them. Right. So in that essence, it's a kind of an inverted mystery in the style of Columbo.
Some authors have just, you know, decided to tackle it. Martin, do you remember Reg Hill's Impossible Crime? I can't remember the title of it, but one of his books he did actually write.
And I'm struggling for title.
Me too. I can't remember how much fun it was, because Reg Hill, I mean, that was not generally the sort of work that he did. But all of a sudden, so I think sometimes, you know, it must be fun for an author not to necessarily specialize. Not to specialize, but in fact, you know, just to give it a shot to see if he or she can do it.
That's absolutely right, Barbara. And I think it's fair to say that, that there's an enormous number of writers over the years, over the past, you know, 150 years plus, who dabble in locked room mysteries without being the specialists that John Dixon Carr was, right. Clayton Dawson, and G.K. Chesterton as well, in Father Brown stories up to a point. But many others have written a few locked room or impossible crime stories. So Conan Doyle wrote one or two. Agatha Christie wrote a handful. Dorothy L. Sayers, a handful. And many, many more. So I think it's something, and you mentioned the great and much missed Reg Hill. I think it's something that many crime writers see as a fun thing to do, to set themselves a challenge. This is an interesting part of the crime genre. Can I have a go, and can I do something with it? And it is something that I think has a continuing appeal. And I think that that's something that's always really interested me. There's a great book about the history of crime fiction, the American book, Murder for Pleasure by Howard Haycraft, written in the 1940s. And in that book, it's a very, very good book, and Haycraft was a very good critic, but he essentially says the locked room mystery is finished. You know, it's gone, goodbye. And they've done everything now. You can't do any more with it. And I think that was quite a widely held view during the second half of the 20th century, even though locked room mysteries continued to be written. And I do agree with Tom that one of the turning points was the Jonathan Creek series, and David Renwick, the scriptwriter, was very influenced by John Dixon Carr. And what David Renwick did was he gave it a fresh spin. So there was comedy, it was contemporary, but the puzzles were good, very good, actually. And it was done in a very witty and appealing way. And I think that shows one of the great truths, really, about crime writing generally, that of course, that there's a limit to the number of ideas there are, and a limit to the number of truly original plot twists you can come up with. That is for sure. But there isn't a limit to the number of voices that you get from authors, the number of styles, the number of different approaches that can be taken. And
yes, I agree completely.
It's really a question, I think, of finding your own voices as a writer and trying to do something fresh, not necessarily 100% fresh with a brand new plot or a brand new explanation for the impossibility. I think the great late Bob Adie, who wrote a wonderful book about locked room murders, said there were essentially 20 different plots in locked room mysteries. You can argue about the precise number, but it's probably something fairly close to that. But he chronicled well over 2,000 locked room mysteries. Not all of them brilliant, but many of them very, very entertaining. So I do think it's what you as a writer bring to the material. And this is the fascination. This is why, even though I'm not by any means someone who specializes in locked room mysteries, I've written a handful of short stories with locked room or impossible crime elements over the years. Probably 4 or 5 stories, and they've usually been slightly unconventional in some way. There's one called Waiting for Godot, which Otto Penzler included in his big anthology of lottery mysteries, and he put it in a category of its own, which I was very, very flattered by, because that from the great Otto, that seemed to be quite an accolade. So I think you try to come up with something that's a little bit different, even if you're also echoing some aspects of what has gone before. This is the nature, I think, of fiction. And in the Puzzle of Blackstone Lodge, for the first time in the 22, 23 novels that I've written, for the first time, there is a locked room mystery. Now, in this book, the locked room mystery isn't the central mystery, but it's the catalyst for much that happens in the story. And essentially, the locked room puzzle is this. At Blackstone Fell, the village of Blackstone Fell, there's a tower, Blackstone Tower, suitably Gothic and macabre in the John Dixon tradition, as Tom has mentioned. And it has a lodge, a gatehouse. And 300 years ago, a man went into that gatehouse and locked, and he vanished. He was never seen again. And then in the early 20th century, same thing happens. Man goes in there, he's observed, but he doesn't come out, he can't be found. And then time passes. We come up to 1930, when the action of the novel is set, and a journalist called Nell Fagan ventures up to Blackstone Fell and is investigating something. We're not quite clear what at the start of the story, but it's quite clear that the lottery mystery plays some kind of part in what she's up to, because she actually takes a short-term tenancy of Blackstone Lodge, which I have to say is a very brave or very foolish thing to do in the context of the story, given what's happened there previously. And guess what? Of course, Nell disappears as well. So that's the lottroom element, the lottroom ingredient of that particular novel. There are plenty of other things going on as well, but it did appeal to me enormously to have this idea for a lottroom puzzle, which I was very taken with, and to integrate it into a larger story and a whole sequence of hopefully very baffling events that ultimately have a series of rational solutions, and that was great fun to do. So the puzzle of Blackstone Lodge is in a sense a lottery mystery. That's a part of the story. It's not the be all and end all of the story by any means, but it is for me a very important part of the story, because it was in some way the spark, the inspiration for the story, as far as I was concerned. And in terms of what happens in the book, it's the starting off point for the character.
Do you think that modern technology is making it harder to write a credible locked room mystery, and that it works better in the context of the Golden Age or before we had so many devices and tools? Tom, if you're going to continue in this vein with locked room mysteries,
Well, I like setting mine in the between the world wars, because obviously it gives me an opportunity to pay tribute to the Golden Age, which is what I enjoy. But there are plenty of what you might call hybrid mysteries, where, for example, the science fiction genre kind of veers into impossible crime territory. There's a very good author called Adam Roberts, who wrote a book called The Real Town Murders, which is set in a sort of distant dystopian future, and it uses this ingenious fictional technology as the kind of core of its plot, but it also features a very clever locked room problem. And what I think is probably an original solution, at least a very devious variation on a theme, if you like. So I think technology certainly makes it more difficult to have a kind of conventional locked room problem. But I think there are certain circumstances where you can actually use it to your advantage to enhance the mystery, if you like.
I really like that idea that technology you can make up might actually work better than technology that exists. That seems to me, you're right. I could easily see that it would be the locked rocket mystery or similar, would retain credibility. I mean, I know authors who've gone to extraordinary lengths, to disable cell phones, for example, gone underground, or, aside from the really, trite thing of the battery running out. But I mean, a big problem with contemporary crime is to disable technology, in such a way that the detective, especially an amateur sleuth, has to get to a solution basically without it, or in spite of it, or however you want to look at it. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that any enterprising criminal today would take their phone where they're going. I mean, you know, even if you look at our January 6th riots, almost all the people that have been convicted did it to themselves, you know, with their own technology. And so, you know, crime fiction, I think one of the joys of it is that, you know, it illuminates society, or what is it we used to say? It cuts along the edge of social change. Crime writers are often, I think, more perspicacious than commentators, you know, than news people and all the rest about what's going on in the world. So,
you know. I agree with that, Barbara. And if I may add, I think that one of the things that we're finding now with Golden Age fiction, now that more and more of it is available, being reprinted, is that the understanding we get of society in those days is actually deeper than a lot of what we get from the conventional history texts. And as somebody pointed out to me the other day, what one of the interesting things is that most of the history of Britain between the wars, for instance, is written by men, whereas a lot of the best Golden Age fiction, as we know, is written by the various queens of crime. And so you get a female perspective on what's going on in the world that is different in some respect from the male perspective. I think that's very illuminating.
Well, certainly the British Library Crime Classics series, of which Martin is the editor and which Poison Pen Press remains the American publisher, has had a huge amount to do with bringing interest back to the Golden Age. And now Tom's publisher does an American classic series from Penslar Publishing. The Library of Congress, not to be outdone by the British Library, is doing its own crime fiction classics. And I can tell you that we sell an enormous amount now of classics, which up until COVID was a section of the store that hardly turned over. And then people really got interested, not just in crime fiction, but, you know, maybe they finally had time to read like War and Peace or something. But now there's a tremendous interest in reading classics, maybe partly because where we are is so uncomfortable. It's hard to live through history. Kate Moss and I talked about this yesterday, and Amanda Foreman, you know, when you're writing historical fiction or reading it, you know how things came out. But when you're living through it, we really don't know, you know. The Regency, so beloved by all the romance writers. Now, that war went on for 20 years and was only resolved in June of 1815. It really could have gone either way for so long. And yet we all know how it came out, so we think it's a deal. We don't know how the Ukraine conflict is going to come out. So it's very hard to live through it. And, you know, I think there is a certain comfort in reading the Golden Age and other kinds of classics for the certainty of it, you know, or if not the certainty, at least the knowledge of how the society anyway behaved, even if we're not sure what the crime story is going to resolve to be.
Yes, that's right. And I think one of the things I argue in the life of crime is that a common thread in crime fiction of many different types is it's not just about the conventional idea of restoring order to a disrupted society, although that's part of it. But I think that what you find in crime fiction of all types, including Patricia Highsmith, who very rarely restores order, you see characters navigating through uncertain worlds. And I think that that's a key part of the appeal of crime fiction to people. And maybe a reason why, as you say, we're living in very uncertain times at present. And it's interesting when you pick up a crime novel, whenever it's written, wherever it's set, whatever subgenre it falls into, you see the characters faced with some kind of very significant uncertainty. And sometimes it's resolved and there's a you know, the suspects are gathered in the library and the detective reveals all and justice is done. And sometimes it isn't. But even then, you get an idea of how people cope or when they're confronted by great difficulties, as with the characters in Highsmith's novel.
Well, certainly in the 1930s, the world was in chaos then, you know. And so I wonder if part of the reason there was so much crime fiction and so much interest in it, again, was that kind of path towards resolution or certainty. So do you guys know that, and I wish I had looked up the title, I'm sorry, but there's a lot of Japanese crime fiction currently being translated and published, and there are at least two locked room mysteries that either came out in June or July from Japanese masters. And I haven't had time, but I've been meaning to pick one up and see what is the locked room. You know, I mean, well, think about Japanese buildings, you know, what is it? Yeah. Where are they locked up?
Well, the most recent one that I can think of that's come out in the UK is, I think it's called The Devil's Flute Murders or something similar. It's by Seishi Okamizo, who's one of the very best and a product of the Japanese Golden Age. He was writing for decades, but he was also writing in the 40s, you know, during the period when the likes of Christie and John Dixon Carr were still very prolific. But the fascinating thing to me about Japanese crime fiction, specifically puzzle mysteries, is this kind of combination of very precise, meticulously constructed puzzles in the vein of, for instance, Ellery Queen, where the puzzle is sort of heightened in the face of literary naturalism. It's more of a kind of surreal exercise in elaborate puzzle solving, but the combination of that puzzle with a kind of stark, gruesome violence, a lot of the Honkaku mysteries, which is what they call the kind of orthodox puzzle mysteries, feature very gruesome murders and very high body counts, which is something that you wouldn't necessarily expect in Golden Age crime fiction, although there are certainly examples of that, including Ellery Queen. I'm thinking of the Egyptian Cross mystery, which is a very gruesome one, and of course Agatha Christie, Hercule Poirot's Christmas, a very bloodthirsty one. When I'm thinking about Japanese locked room mysteries, I find it very interesting to look at the correlations with the Golden Age of British and American mystery, and also where it diverges significantly. Interestingly enough, Carr also had a great sense of, he was influenced in his early days by Poe. So he had a knack for the kind of lurid, very florid prose in his early books, which is something that you can still see as a kind of thread through the development of the Honkaku mystery as well. So I find that very interesting.
I think it's great to see that other cultures, you know, because so much of crime fiction, older crime fiction, was really an American or a British, you know, genre. And now we're finding out that, in fact, you know, it's international. The New York Times just did a whole book review issue on translation, you know, books in translation. And we're seeing so much more of other cultures and the kinds of things. I mean, you know, a society that dreamed up seppuku, in my opinion, could easily write pretty brutal, you know, locked mysteries.
Yes, exactly. Right. And what I've tried to do with the sequel to The Murder Wheel, which is going to be coming out next summer, I've tried to kind of, if you like, return the favor and incorporate some of the Honkaku puzzle plot elements into a Golden Age framework. It's a sort of fun experiment, if you like, to draw on the likes of Seishi Okamizo, Soji Shimada, Yukito Tsuji, so many others that are finally being translated into English.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Japan has actually always been a huge market for many of us independent bookstores here in the States who ship have big lists of Japanese customers. So the fact that their own market is, you know, coming along. So, Martin, you came to life. You were in the dark there for a while. What happened?
Well, it was quite light when we started. It got darker and darker, so I thought the lights needed to go on.
Ah, you turned the lights on. Good. But you were kind of like,
well, that'd be light. Yeah, well, I was tempted to go with the macabre dark one, but... with our topic, but I thought maybe not. And I do very much agree with what Tom said about the Japanese writers. And I think it bears out the point I was making earlier on, which is this, that they have taken the inspiration from a number of British writers and some American writers, and they name check. This is one of the interesting things to me. They actually name check these Anglo-American Golden Age writers in some of the novels. But then, as Thomas mentioned, they take, they take those ideas and they do something fresh with them, as Tom says. You get an element of the gruesome to a degree that you don't get in the Golden Age. So if you take Soji Shimada and the Tokyo Zodiac murders, that's a very significant crime novel in Japanese mystery history. And you see very clearly that he's using a lot of the devices that we're very familiar with in the Golden Age, but he's doing something new with them. That I think is incredibly interesting.
Well, it's wonderful. And it's wonderful that they are now available to readers of English, you know, language, so that we can do that. Martin, now that we can actually see you, why don't you tell us? I sort of hesitated to go into Clue Finders because finding Martin might be the ultimate theme of this.
But this is a mystery shop.
Right.
Clue Finders. Well, Clue Finders are really an aspect of the game that Tom was talking about. And I agree with everything that he said about the game. The big thing that came into the genre after the First World War was that the idea of playing fair with the reader changed, it evolved. When Conan Doyle was writing Sherlock Holmes, he was very keen to play fair. But for him, that meant showing the reader how Holmes had arrived at his deduction. But in the Golden Age, the writers like Christie and Barclay and others take this idea of fair play a lot further. They challenge the reader to solve the mystery. So they give them the clues, but they hope to misdirect. And again, like this is something that Tom's already touched on. That they hope to use their skills at misdirection so that the reader doesn't pick everything up. And so you had the books with the formal challenge to the reader, something Ellery Queen specialised in for many years, and a number of other British and American writers had this formal challenge to the reader. So you reach chapter 20 or whatever it is, and you ask the question, yeah, you've now got all the clues. What's the answer to this particular problem? And you have the sealed mysteries, the publishing gimmick. So the final chapters will be sealed up. And if you weren't enjoying the story, the idea was you took the book back with the seal unbroken and got your money back, but you didn't find out whether your solution was correct. So finding the...
Here we are. Here's a challenge to the reader from the murder wheel.
Exactly.
So if you can see that there. But sort of stepping out of the narrative and addressing the reader directly.
That's exactly it.
But if you're doing that cat and mouse game that you talked about, Tom, then that's a reasonably logical extension, you know, because it really is, it's more, you know, it's more conversation or at least a challenge between the author and the reader than it is between the characters. And so you're stepping out of the story to do it makes perfectly
precisely. And there's a great level of self-awareness, I think, in the golden age that you're discussing there, Martin, that burgeoning clue finder challenge to the reader. It I think of it as quite ahead of its time with the likes of John Dixon Carr, The Three Coffins, aka The Hollow Man. You have Gideon Fell addressing one of the other characters, making this kind of metafictional discussion of locked room mysteries, and also this sort of throwaway comment. Of course, we know that we're characters in a murder mystery. I think that's something that's very ahead of its time, very sort of postmodern, before postmodern. Yes, Ellery Queen they had a great knack for that, I should say. And that's certainly where I got the idea for the challenge to the reader in mind.
What about the crossword puzzle? I know one of the Josephine Tay books, which I always loved, had a person up in a tree. Niall Marsh, not Josephine Tay. One of her books, our crossword puzzle working, was big. And then, of course, there's Colin Dexter. We just watched The Last Endeavor, which, you know, is sad because, you know, nothing good can happen to Endeavor, right? Because we know about Morse. I mean, there's no optimism here. But there was a crossword puzzle on the Don's desk, you know, and I wondered if they were going to flirt with, you know, Endeavor solving it. But Dexter himself, wasn't he an examiner at Oxford? Wasn't that his role, Martin?
He worked for the examination board. He wasn't an examiner as such. He wasn't the Don, but he worked for the examination board. And of course, he was a great crossword puzzle contestant, and also he set crossword puzzles as well. He's very, very gifted in that field, and he was someone who really led the way from mid 70s onwards in reviving the traditional detective story when it was totally out of fashion in critical terms, and he really showed that there was a market out there for the well-made puzzle story. And that was at a time when it was all, you know, Ruth Rendell and psychological suspense and that kind of thing. And I think that the appeal of the puzzle, whether it's the crossword or whether it's the mystery and the detective story, whatever it is very strong. And, you know, we like to have a puzzle to solve and to challenge ourselves to try to figure it out. We feel frustrated if we can't get all the answers. And to go back to the clue finder, that's a specific example of that, because you have the challenge to the reader where which may be explicit, as in Tom's book and as in Ellery Queen and as in a number of others in the Golden Age, or it may be implicit, as with Agatha Christie. So there's not a formal challenge to reader, but it's the same idea that the reader, if the reader wants to, can try and figure it out before Hercule Poirot does, although most of us feel more like Captain Hastings for most of the time. But
you can just go for a ride through the book, or you can actually try to interact with the book. I think, you know, that's readers, you know.
It's the choice. It's personal choice. I mean, there are those, including Mrs. Edwards, who actually did the map in Blackstone Fell. She will peek at the end, which I think is sacrilegious, but you know, it's different people have different approaches to these things.
And
the idea of the clue finder is that at the end of the story, the clues are set out, so you have page references, and the reader can, in effect, check whether they spotted all the clues. And this came in the late 1920s, continued in the 30s in quite a number of books, and then petered out really not long after the Second World War. And Kingsley Amis came up with a tiny little clue finder in one book in the early 70s, and then that was that. And so when I wrote Mortmain Hall, I felt I would like to bring it back 50 years later. And the response from readers was very positive. So there's another clue finder in Blackstone Fell, or puzzle at Blackstone Lodge, and there's another one in Sepulchre Street.
Right, which I love. And I'm so glad that Tom is doing something, you know, unique to his books. And we have now talked, guys, for 50 minutes. So why don't we see if Ian has anything that he would like to present to us from the audience? Any questions come in, Ian?
Yes, there are a few questions here. For both of you, what are your favorite types of puzzles?
Puzzles in terms of locked rooms, for me, it is ones that have a hint of the supernatural about them. So talking about mystery plots, I would say, for instance, Paul Altair, the French author, he is somebody who's very much in the mold of John Dixon Carr, and his mystery puzzles have a real hint of the uncanny about them. But of course, they have that rational, logical explanation at the end. But the way that he constructs them, they have that kind of sense of the surreal and the bizarre, which is something that's there in Carr as well. But Altair really heightens it quite brilliantly, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I very much agree about Paul Altair. For me, I think the ideal is a story where people, characters, puzzle, plot, and place, setting, are all significant in the story. But I really do like all the different types of crime fiction. The one thing I look for is that the writer does it well, whatever branch they're going into, that it kind of works. Given what they were trying to do. And I think it's always important to judge a book by what the author was trying to do rather than what you think they should have tried to do. That's a rather different thing.
Absolutely true. I know it. I'm getting ready to write an Indigna. As soon as I can write again, instead of one finger, I'm living on emojis right now because it's the best I can do. I'm going to write a really indignant letter to the New York Times Book Review because they have now gone mostly with authors reviewing other authors, which gives them some of the time a real stake in, you know, in the review. And there was one recently that was all about what the reviewing author thought the book should have been instead of what the book actually was. And there was sort of an axe to grind in it. And I was really enraged by that. I haven't been able to protest, but you're so right that you really need to judge it not by what you wanted, but what the author tried to do. And then we've left out, you know, that other magic ingredient, which is how well did the author say it? Because, you know, a deadly prose style, a clunking prose style, regardless of how great the puzzle is, can really be a killer. You know, if you're boring, if your prose is boring, then there's not a lot of hope for it, regardless of how clever the puzzle is.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I do admire ambition in a writer in a book. And I think that an ambitious book, even with flaws, maybe quite serious flaws, it tends to be one that I prefer to something that's relatively formulaic.
Ian?
Have either of you ever gone through an escape room? And if so, how did you like it?
That's a great question. I haven't been through a proper escape room, but I did do various kinds of during lockdown. Everybody was trying to do these kind of virtual murder mysteries and escape rooms, and yeah, it was great fun.
I've never done it, and I suspect if I did, I'd never get out.
Yeah, same here. I'm somebody who is hopeless at actually unraveling a puzzle, which is why when I'm reading a murder mystery, I'm somebody who just is swept along. I don't try to play along. But when I get to this solution, I then have great fun using the clue finder. I like rereading mysteries, knowing what the solution is and seeing how clever the writer has been. That's the that's the kind of key feature for me of the puzzle mystery. That's the appeal. seeing how the tricks are yeah. played.
Yeah.
Ian?
For Tom, do you know any magic tricks?
Yes, this one comes up all the time. And unfortunately, the answer is no, because I don't have the leisure demand to pull them off. And I don't have the memory for card tricks, which are so convoluted and multifarious. But there are different types of magic tricks. And I always think that, you know, a good mystery is like a magic trick in that it operates on with the same principles of misdirection, etc. So I tend to think of the books as being the closest I'll get to a magic trick.
What kinds of research do you both do to help write your books?
Well, I certainly do a lot of research, partly because I long ago ran out of the things that I actually know. So I have to research. And I do think research is very important. And it's extremely important in the Rachel Savernay books, such as The Puzzle at Blackstone Lodge, because, of course, you're looking back 90 years. A different world. I have read an awful lot of books of that time. That's very helpful. But there are all kinds of little details that that can trip you up if you're not careful. So I consult experts on things like the cars of the time or what London, a particular London pub was like in the 1930s, that sort of thing. I research places. I mentioned with the puzzle at Blackstone Lodge, I went to this place, Hardcastle Crags, and also a couple of other places which contributed certain geographical features. Because I do think that although one is writing fiction, it's important, maybe even more important than when you're writing nonfiction, to have that feel of authenticity. And it's very, very easy to lose your reader. So with Mortmain Hall, the second Rachel book, there's quite a bit in it about the drinks that the characters consume in one chapter. I researched that quite intensively. And then one of the very first reviews was by someone who's a wine buff. And believe me, I was very relieved that that I'd researched it and that it passed with flying colours as far as that review is concerned, because it would be so easy to get a little detail wrong. Of course, you can never achieve perfection, but I do think it's important to strive for it and to do your best to get those details right. And not just the factual details, but the mood of the times, the way that people behaved. Would they really have done this or said this at the time, accepting, of course, that it's a story. And so you're allowed some things that are implausible, but it's got to be implausible in an authentic way, I feel, if that makes sense.
I think it's got to be, coming back to the idea of fair play, it's got to play fair by its own internal logic. If you're deviating from historical fact, you need to still play fair within that framework that you've set up. I like Martin, I do a lot of research into the period because my stories are essentially theatrical mysteries. There's a lot of backstage detail and things like that. So I had a lot of fun, particularly with the murder wheel, researching the sort of backstage gossip of the 30s and 40s, the kind of all the little fun details. But of course, there's a wealth of theatrical murder mysteries from the Golden Age. It's a very popular subgenre, if you like. Niall O'Marsh wrote tons of them, and one that I held up briefly is one of my personal favorites, Death of Jezebel by Christiana Brand. That's a great example of a theatrical mystery. But my main research is in magic. So this is a favorite of mine, Magic Explained, which is a book from 1949, which was one of the first magic books that I came across, and which sort of was my gateway to the to the field, if you like, you know, just learning how the likes of, I mean, they're listed on the cover, Harry Blackstone, Chung Ling Soo, who's mentioned in the Murder Wheel, David Devant, who's also mentioned in the Murder Wheel, Harry Houdini, all these kinds of great magicians from history, how their tricks were worked. And I would often find reading things like that, that some of their ingenious gimmicks, the principles are readily applicable to the locked room subgenre. That's, if you like, the secret to the Spectre Mysteries. It's that correlation between magic and mystery. And obviously, you, to pull it off, so to speak, you you need to have a very wide reading in the field of magic.
And finally, have either of you ever read anything by Edward Hoke? And if so, what did you think of him?
Yes, well, Ed Hoke was someone I knew. He wrote one or two stories for anthologies that I edited. And I was Andrew Main, a huge fan. He wrote a lot of impossible crime short stories, but he wrote a huge number of short stories, about 1,000. Yeah. He's incredibly prolific. He had one in every issue of Elder Queen's Mystery Magazine for 30 odd years, didn't he? So he was remarkable, and he's also a very, very kind and generous man in my personal experience of him. And he was brilliant at plot, and I think he's an excellent example of someone who does take ideas that may have been around for a long time. But again, he brings his own spin very often by taking one of his serious characters and the world of that character gives the fresh feel to the story. And there's one of his stories, which because we talk about impossible crimes, I'll mention, but I could mention many of them. There's a story called The Vanishing of Velma, and that's a very, very good one.
Yes, I'm a big fan of Edward Hoke. When people ask me about my detective character, Joseph Spector, and the kind of inspirations, I will often mention his series character, Simon Ark, who is very interesting because rather like Agatha Christie's Mr. Quinn, he's a character who has a hint of the supernatural about him. He has this idea that he is a kind of mystical being. He claims to be this 2,000-year-old Coptic priest, which, of course, we don't know if that's just, if that's just bunkum or if he really is. But the stories are, of course, Fair Play, Impossible Crimes, but they've got a very Carian sense of the macabre, which I enjoy. But the characterization of Simon Ark was certainly a big influence on me writing the Spectre character. I'm also a big fan of the Sam Hawthorne series, which is, I think, is his longest running series. But it's the Simon Ark ones that I keep coming back to because they seem to chime the best with my own particular taste for, you know, things that are a little bit out there, a little bit unusual.
There's a lovely man called Doug Green who ran something called Crippen and Landrieu Press. And one of the things he did was collect short stories into volumes. And he did probably, what, three? Anyway, two for sure, I think, collections of Ed Hoke stories.
They recently reissued some of the Simon Ark's Funeral in the Fog. I think they're doing the Captain Leopold mysteries coming out, I think, possibly later this year.
Well, it's good to know. I've sort of lost track, so I'll have to get back on it and figure it out. Because if things are published in magazines, you know, sort of ephemerally, then it's great to have somebody collect them in a more durable form. So anyway, guys, it's been a terrific discussion. Thank you very much for spending an hour with us. I want to thank all of our audience for joining us. I'm holding up again the Puzzle of Blackstone Lodge, and Ian is holding up probably our remaining copy, but we can get more of the Murder Wheel. And Tom, you want to hold up your first book again for people who might want to start?
Yes, certainly. It's just come out in paperback, Death and the right. Conjurer.
Death of the Conjurer.
Introduces the Spectre character.
Right. So what a great treat. Thank you very much, guys. Enjoy the rest of your summer. And Martin, are you coming to BoucherCon?
I am indeed.
Oh, good. Well, I will see you there. I will look forward,
to it, Barbara.
How about you, Tom? Are you coming?
Not this year, next year, 2024, I'll be there.
In Nashville. Well, San Diego versus Nashville. That'll be a lot of fun. Wonderful. Anyway, bye, everybody. Thank you. Bye. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.